Africa, you invite the red man to sit at your table and be your guest, to justify the guilt that you are feeling. Now you tell us that you like us the best, and the black man waiting on the sidelines for the chance to get into your game, to show you that he's just as good as you are, to prove to you that he can be the same. And the triangle that you have created keeps you by yourself and keeps you paranoid. For the red, white, and blue that you keep flying, for the red, white, and black that you avoid, 'cause the red man was here so long before you, while the black man was a slave you brought ashore. And the red man was killed to free the frontier, while the black man was killed for sport and nothing more. And you wonder why the red man won't be like you. You should wonder why the black man wants to be. And you came to this land because you wanted freedom, but that you have forgotten now that you are free.
And good morning, everybody. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. I'm your host, Paul Roland. This is the second Wednesday of the month. So we have, as always, thankfully, Jacqueline Keeler. Good morning.
Good morning, Paul.
And we just heard Floyd Westerman from his epic album of 1969, Custer Died for Your Sins. And that was called Red, White, and Black. Brings up a lot of issues, that song, and we're going to bring up a lot of issues today. I titled this song, The Unbearable Whiteness of Being in Black and Red Face. And of course, we're talking about that because of what's been going on in Virginia and beyond. Of course, it's a phenomenon that goes way beyond Virginia, this phenomenon that goes back almost 100 years of white people dressing up in blackface, the whole history of minstrelsy, the whole history of the bizarre psychosocial power dynamics involved in that. But we're also going to be talking more about the idea of red face, which is a phenomenon that actually has been gotten less attention. And we're going to be talking about why Jacqueline and other Native folks feel that that is the case. So start it off.
Yeah, where to start? Well, I mean, it's interesting because I was just in Jamestown a year ago.
Uh-huh.
I was invited to speak. I'm a Native journalist, and I write about a lot of issues, and I get invited to speak to students at universities and colleges around the United States. And so I was invited to speak at the College of William and Mary, which is one of our oldest colleges in the country. And of course, it's there in Williamsburg, historic colonial Williamsburg. And of course, just down the road is Jamestown, right? And so I had just done a ton of research on Pocahontas and the history of Jamestown and her, you know, the whole thing about her being taken. She was kidnapped and raped by the Jamestown settlers, kind of held to extract demands from her father, Powhatan, who was the chief, and then taken to England and then died there. And she was very young, and so I went to go check it out. And definitely the history there, that's the origin story of America, and it's really based in this profit motive. I think I've talked about that before with colonialism and these early joint stock companies like the one that funded Jamestown, the Virginia Company of Adventurers based in London, and that were given governmental powers by the crown. And so that was just a crazy thing. And when I spoke to the students there, most of them are from Virginia, and they have this idea of Virginia being the birthplace of democracy. And I was like, well, you know, Virginia is also the birthplace of racism, of white supremacy. You know, the early laws that were established there to create a race-based hierarchy. You know, giving when the European indentured servants allied with people stolen from Africa, and they became a threat to the ruling class, to the planter elite, and quickly they decided how to divide and conquer that group, and that was by skin color.
So that was really early on. That was, you know, people think of escaped slaves going to the, you know, the the swamps in Florida
or North Carolina.
Or North Carolina, but this is even earlier. This is like the kind of the first incident of that.
Right? Yeah, this was in the 1600s. Yeah, so so that became a sort of a tool to divide and conquer us, and that continues to this day. I mean, and I did tell the students, I was like, you know, at the time I was talking to them, Trump was kind of saber rattling with North Korea, and I was like, you know, if the end of the world happens, I mean, the vote for Trump was really along racial lines. You know, people who consider themselves to be white under this caste system created in Virginia, you know, voted for him in the majority. You know, and they are his base. You know, and if he, you know, he could it literally white supremacy created here in Virginia could bring about the end of the world if nuclear war were initiated, or even longer term with climate change.
Of course, it may not be such long term if you heed the more worst case scenarios of what's going on with the methane clathrates in the Arctic Sea. But anyway, let's leave that aside for now. So yeah, there's a lot to unpack. As we said, I have a book. Speaking of Red, White, and Black, there's this book called Red, White, and Black: The Peoples of Early America by Gary Nash, who's one of those kind of the new historians coming out of the kind of the 60s, relooking at, I don't know how familiar are you, I'm sure there's a lot to be critical of, but he's does a lot of some of the, you know, the from a white established academic perspective, some of the, I think, better sort of relooking at the real nitty-gritty history of the actual social relationships between the different groups. And I was reading this history of Jamestown. My God, what a mess they just threw, and not just the, I mean, they later threw, you know, the what he calls the riffraff or whatever, the, you know, people, either prisoners, people who are basically suffered from the, you know, the industrialization and were kind of uprooted from their lands, or, you know, whatever, people who are not the gentlemen. But they first threw a whole bunch of gentlemen at this so-called gentleman, and like 2,000 of them died. I mean, they kept throwing wave after wave after wave at this attempt to form a colony in Jamestown, basically because they thought there was gold. And they were constantly digging. They were digging for gold. Can you imagine? But then the gentleman didn't want to work. So he had all these horrible, you know, basically you had the few people, John Smith was actually one of them. He was like one of the people who actually had some real life experience. You know, he had fought in all sorts of he was a mercenary. Anyway, so could you just imagine these people, like this pathetic attempt to emulate the Spaniards who had such a resounding success in enslaving the native people and basically creating massive wealth, you know, saving the royal families of Spain and Portugal by all this wealth. So that's what they were trying to do.
I should point out that King Philip, he declared bankruptcy four times in that time period because he spent all the money on war, right? And or all the gold and stuff on war. And right. So that whole history of Jamestown, you know, America likes to look at this whole idea of it rising out of rights, human rights, or, you know, freedom of religion, all this stuff, looking at Plymouth. But I think that Jamestown is a more correct origin story. It's earlier, and it really does point to the methodology of colonialism, and particularly the profit motive, which the joint stock companies created and exemplified, because, of course, the crown could not fund colonialism on its own. So it turned to its subjects and allowed them to create these companies and gave them charters and patents. And so you have instances where you know, you have the folks who could buy stock in the company, they were given guaranteed amounts of land, and they were owners in the company. The other ones who came, some of them were kidnapped off the streets, you know, I mean, and sent, put on the ship, especially children, you know, and they were seen as very disposable, you know, as human waste. And so they were worked to death, and even the young lords who went there, they were sometimes, because of the profit motive, they were chained to their beds, and if they didn't work, it was very hard. It was, they also, the location was, but anyway, we're getting a little bit, probably too, yes, much detail about Jamestown. But the issue is that the origins of a lot of what we experience today have very troubling roots, and they are about control, and they are not benign. And so when people, you know, the history of blackface and the history of redface are about control of another group and the supremacy of a group that is given power simply to, in some cases, you know, given the given a certain amount of power to basically placate it, you know. I mean, one of the things I point out with when I wrote about Warren is that, you know, her story,
Elizabeth Warren,
yeah, and of course,
which is why you were going to Jamestown and looking into Pocahontas, because she was called Pocahontas by Trump, so, yeah.
No, I was actually, let me do that, yeah, but
it was connected.
Not really. I was actually looking at for my book about the Bundys, looking at the history, okay, and the how, you know, what the things they are referring to. You know, they talk about a lot of rights and all this stuff, and I was really trying to trace that back intellectually and understand it. And it did take me to the English Civil War.
Anyway, Elizabeth Warren.
Yeah, Elizabeth Warren. You know, she of course has she's sort of a Rachel Dolezal figure. You know, people are trying to give her a pass. And it's, you know, if she'd been claiming to be black all these years and had no proof, I think that the issue would be very, you know, I mean, there's a thing in which things that they can, other groups, they would never get away with pretending. Like, even if she'd been pretending to be Sri Lankan, right, and she had zero proof and putting it on employment records and stuff like that, people would think she was crazy, you know. But anyone can claim to be Native because of genocide, because in the absence of Native people, anything is believable. And you have to really think about that. Like, in the absence, in you're living in a genocide, right? And this is what makes...
You're talking about where she was from.
She has zero proof. I mean,
right.
No connection.
But you're saying that obviously genocide wasn't complete because you're still here. You're talking about where Elizabeth, where her family was from.
Yes, and, in a white perspective, the, right, genocide is complete.
Okay.
You know, because for Native people, obviously we know the genocide is not complete because we're here. But to white people, we are invisible. And I can tell you how many times when I meet a white person, the first thing they say to me is, wow, I thought you were all gone. You're the first Native person I've ever met. And that happens probably 75% of the time. So to white people, yeah, we are, the genocide is real. And I talked to folks in Oklahoma, Native people, and they said Oklahoma City, where she grew up, is very white. It's not an Indian country, you know, there and stuff. So yeah, she went to a high school that was completely white. It had no black students. It was before, you know, integration of the schools. And so and she benefited from that. And that's the thing, is that, you know, you know, there is a level of which white people don't understand the rest of the country, because they live in a bubble created by their whiteness and their privilege, and they don't know any, they have no way to relating to it, you know, except through force.
And so let's set the stage a little better here. So, you know, a lot of people understand the idea of blackface, you know, because it's, well, you know, like the issue of like the restaurant Sambo's was a big deal. What was that, like 15, 20 years ago?
I think it was longer, like.
Longer, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I think.
And you know, but there are, you know, people understand that, as you said, that that's either they may not agree with it, but they understand that, you know, in general, cultural norms have shifted and that that's not really okay. And they understand that there is this thing of people putting on blackface, and people still do it. You know, obviously this now governor of Virginia did it in the 80s, and people still do it. People still do it for Halloween, just like people dress up as Native people. And
although I'd have to say that the Pew Research came out with a study just a few, on the 11th, on Monday, that found that a third of Americans say blackface in a Halloween costume is acceptable. So there is a large group of white people who are still incredibly clueless and don't understand even that subject. You know, I mean, I can imagine what they think of red face, right? And so once again, their whiteness creates a real impediment to a truly pluralistic society in which everyone is respected and represented, because they still hold the power. You know, they can elect Trump. They can put in someone who is anathema to every single value that most Americans hold, right? That's their power, and they revel in it. And watching him say all those things, he's not speaking to Native voters. He's speaking to his base, and his base is white.
So we're talking here about black and red face and related subjects. This is Wednesday Talk Radio. It is a call-in show, and the number is 503-231-8187. So, you know, there's a long history to blackface, which can be, you know, largely traced to this the minstrelsy and the whole, this, you know, white performers dressing up, putting on blackface and imitating, you know, and there's a really grotesque aspect to it, because early on they really exaggerated, you know, the supposed traits which they imputed to African Americans because of their own guilt or superiority or whatever, but of, you know, of laziness, of hypersexuality, of all these traits that were included in these minstrel shows, and exaggerated speech patterns, et cetera, et cetera. Red face, let's talk about what that is, the phenomenon of, you know, we know it mainly through, you know, sports mascots and people, you know, painting their faces and dress up in feathers, and Halloween, of course, which is a, you know, both of which are, you know, we're talking about a governor who, you know, you do say that 30% of white people still think that it's acceptable to dress up in Halloween, but it's a,
that was for blackface.
For blackface, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, we do think of it still as something that's has somewhat receded from our culture, whereas, you know, to the extent that's true or not is an open question. But whereas sports stadiums, like all across the country, yeah, routinely people do paint their faces red and dress, yeah, up in feathers, and it seems to be relatively acceptable.
Well, I mean, and you can go to any Halloween store and buy an Indian outfit, you know, a sexy squaw outfit or whatever, or a fake headdress. And but you can't buy, you know, something where you would look like, you know, Mammy, right? That would be completely unacceptable. That would be protested and shut down. And yet we have Native people every year protesting these shops, and there's a little coverage, but there's no action. You know, none of these stores have stopped selling it, or websites. And I think that you know, having these teams that play, you know, like when Florida State, the Seminoles, played the Rose Bowl, you know, even against U of O, right? They had a whole stadium, you know, with 90,000 people and chanting and doing tomahawk chops and dressing up and, you know, and doing all this stuff, and you know all the girls in sexy squaw outfits and all this stuff, and
nationally televised,
yes,
and everything.
Yeah, and the team, the school's band was playing that awful, that da da da, you know, every time that they scored a goal, and you could hear that. And my son was like 11 years old at the time, and he was like, "What's that sound? What is that?" And it was horrible, because I was like, "This isn't something I want to continue into this century and for this generation. I want it to end." And the issue is that I came up with the term masketry to describe all the performative aspects of mascots. You know, people will often say, "Well, why are you upset about this image? It's a handsome warrior," you know. But it's what they do with it that's the problem, and it's encapsulated in a form of revelry that does not have the normal social rules to constrain it. You know, sort of similar to carnival or these sorts of things, and so it's not something you want, things that are sacred to you, that are important to you, to be put into, to be subject to, and particularly by people who are, you know, traditionally your enemies, and who are basically performing a form of triumphalism, like an old Roman triumph, you know, where they paraded their enemies, their captured kings, and the barbarian king through the streets so people could, see their power. And it really is more akin to that than celebrating our actual cultures and who we are.
That's all too obvious. And as I wrote on this program page, you've been writing and fighting against racist mascots and stereotypes for years, and you're pretty sick of it. But here you are talking about it still.
I know. I was like on Al Jazeera last week, I think. I was just like, oh my God, I'm sort of tired of this. I mean, these same talking points. And talking about Warren and the issue between sovereignty and race-based nonsense. You know, that race doesn't exist. It's not a thing, people. We are sovereign nations. Native people are citizens of tribal nations that pre-exist and persist the creation of the United States. And that's what we have. And if you want to do right by us, you treat us that way and you talk about us that way. And what Warren has done has been the exact opposite of that.
So we've talked about that fairly extensively. But there's, of course, new things have developed. She has officially launched her campaign for president, and she has apologized. So maybe we should take a few minutes, and because I know you've been called upon to do interviews and write about that, which you've been doing for, you're probably getting sick of that too. But she's not going away. And what do you think of her apology and the continuing and how some Native groups have sort of gone along with it? I know that we talked about that last time.
Yeah, I think that, her apology took 7 years, right? And before she apologized to the Cherokee Nation, she first did the DNA stunt and tried to one-up Trump, right? Very badly done. And equating our identity with some sort of minuscule amount of DNA 10 generations back. You have to realize 10 generations back, you have 1,024 great-great-great-great-great-grandparents in that generation. Having one of those folks be Native American cannot be equated with actual citizenship in a modern Native nation.
Which she has recognized.
Well, the thing is, though, when you look at that, where she was being questioned by, she was kind of surrounded by reporters in the Senate hallway, she kept saying that, like, I am sorry for causing confusion between tribal sovereignty and citizenship. And but the reporters weren't listening. The white reporters, they didn't care about that. And I think that a lot of this discussion we have in this country is not understood by the general public in specifics, in substance. It's only understood in semiotics, in gestures. So the gesture of taking a DNA test and what it is supposed to mean speaks much more to the public, to hundreds of millions of Americans, and misinforms them to a much greater degree than her later commentary.
And perhaps especially those who are so keen on supporting her as president.
Yes, and the apology was a private one. It wasn't done with the Cherokee Nation released to the media the announcement. It was a private phone call. She never commented on it until the Washington Post released, what they found, which was that she had actually, written Native American on it. See, a lot of people have family stories and they have this sort of thing, but she's an attorney. She understands the difference between hearsay and evidence, right? She has no evidence that she's Native American. I mean, the Cherokee Nation, the top genealogists in the Cherokee Nation did her family tree going back, 10 generations. She has no Native ancestry. I mean, when they do that research, they not only look at her direct ancestors, they look at their cousins, their family, their extended family, to see if there's any records showing that they lived in a Native American community. They were marked on any paperwork as Indian, and there is none.
So the other thing that happened, which you just alluded to, which is that she checked a box on her registration for the Texas bar.
She hand-wrote in Native American.
Native American. So, we don't want to beat this into the ground, but so, I mean, do you think she really believes that she's actually,
identifies? What would you do if you thought she were Native? Would you just mark these things kind of behind, closed doors? Or would you go engage with the Native community? And she has never done that. Even when the tribe was trying to speak to her, they told me on the record, the Cherokee Nation, that she had promised them that she would tell them before she did something like a DNA test. And she didn't tell them.
And so basically, it's to me, the only interpretation you give is she thought she had something to gain from doing that.
And a delegation of Cherokee women went to meet her in 2012 in Massachusetts to present her genealogy, and she refused to meet them. And on top of that, her staffer denounced them to the press as being out of state, an out-of-state organization that that was sponsored by extremists.
Well, with that, let's perhaps go to our first caller. Michael, go ahead. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have a question that I'm really puzzled by about this. I've heard all sorts of things or read things about the history of blackface, but then things happened like a couple of years ago at OSU. There was this lady, kind of an older lady, law professor, who dressed up like a black doctor who she admired at Halloween, and she got into lots of trouble for that and almost got fired. And it seems to me that there's a difference between caricaturing some other race versus you want to look like somebody you admire as a costume for Halloween. And I don't understand why she got in so much trouble. Do you understand that?
Yeah, I think it goes back to the history. Everything has context, you know. And I think that that the context of blackface is still far too fraught to do that. And when will that context go away? And I think that's, it comes down to a power issue. As long as every statistic shows that that black people in this country are marginalized and discriminated against and even murdered for being black, and you see with all these things coming out with racism that many white people hold internally, which is exemplified by their vote for Trump, and that there is a real issue there. She may view it one way, but what's the larger context of how it's viewed? And that's what she has to take into consideration. And that's really what I mean. Just in the same way, they demand that young black men not wear hoodies, right, or carry Skittles. You know, I think that it's incumbent on white people to practice a certain amount of awareness of their situation when they live in a pluralistic society in which they have been dominant for hundreds of years.
Okay, well, thank you, Michael. Looks like we got, let's just go to our next caller. It says Camilo, but it might be Camillo. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Yes, Camilo, thank you. I think that in its essence, question that these issues of blackface, redface, Elizabeth Warren, Rachel Dolezal touch upon is passing. And of course, most of the passing is passing up. And we have these two examples of people passing down, so to speak. But a question that I don't think has really been explored is that of American, Native, Indigenous people passing as white. And I imagine it's probably fairly easy because of the physiognomy is not often so distinct from that of white people. And since they're largely urbanized, I imagine it's very easy for that to happen. And I wonder if there's just much discussion or information about that.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I'll address the first part and then the second part. The first part about passing down, I think that the question is, why would they do that unless they thought they had something to gain, right? And the second part is that what are actual people of color losing when they do that? In the situation specifically of Warren, the Boston Globe did an investigation which found that Harvard basically hired her as a white woman. It wasn't because she was Native, basically. But they also found that her hiring, and then later after she would be hired, she did this both at the University of Pennsylvania and Harvard. After she was hired, she would then request officially in the employment records that her race be changed from white to Native American, right? And so later, when Harvard was being criticized for not having a diverse faculty, they would trot her out. They would say, look, we've hired a Native American woman to be our law professor. And that's actually delayed the actual hiring of a woman of color by at least 2 years. And so there is a loss there when that happens. And there is a certain level in which the appropriation of Native identity and Native culture, there is something very acquisitive about it and feels incredibly, it feels like a taking. And it feels like there's something incredibly colonialistic about it and imperialistic. And so I don't know that it fits within a progressive sort of movement, and it should not be expressed by a progressive leader. The second half of your question, which is about Native people passing, right? So, you know, you're right. I mean, being Native American is not a racial thing for Native nations. You know, we have tribal members, enrolled tribal members, who citizens of Native nations who could pass for any race, right? And race is, of course, not a scientific thing, right? It's not actually a thing. So, but of course, the results of what people perceive are is real, right? So I, you know, we, of course, we all have members of our family, you know, extended family who may pass as white, right? And certainly our families, our Native families, benefit from that, from having kind of moles in the white world, I would say. You know, people who can go in, get that white salary, you know, and bring it back to their Indian family, right? And that is a benefit to many Native families. It kept them alive. It kept them afloat during, you know, the worst of kind of the Jim Crow era. I mean, it was just as bad in South Dakota as it was in Mississippi for Native people. And so having that slight edge was sometimes the difference between between really falling, you know, into dire poverty and not, right?
Well, so, my question is that there's a whole literature about Black people passing and then being discovered and the scandal that brings. I mean, there's fictional works, there's social science works, but I've never heard anything about the issue of Native people passing.
The thing is that, you know, often there's people who are pretendians, you know, often cite that, oh, my family hid out and pretended to be white for 150 years, right? And there's a point where, well, once you experience all the benefit of whiteness for several generations, well, how are you, you know, my family, my Native family, were deeply impacted intergenerationally by the depredations of a white supremacist society. My grandfather was beaten to death by the city of Yankton police, right, in custody, much. And so it's there's a level in which the trauma that we experience because of the terrorism that white supremacy enacts on the rest of the population that is not white is incredibly, you know, this is a legacy of being American, right?
So is that, you're saying that's why it isn't discussed because
the thing is that if they can tribally enroll, they're not really hiding out. They're actually still parts of Native families. Right. My father, you know, was 5/8 Dakota. Right. And to some white people, he could pass as white. I mean, he looked kind of like Anthony Bourdain or Dan Rather. He kind of looked like that, you know, and even on his, you know, and so so that did allow him to move in the white world more easily without being questioned a lot. And his Indian family benefited from that. Me and my family, my mother's a full-blood Navajo, we benefited from that, for sure. But it didn't stop him from being part of a Native community, you know, or being part of a Native family, or having Native children, you know. And so I think that's where it's different, is that most Native people tend to stick with their families and their communities. There's a deep connection there. And folks who kind of become white, it's... you know, I don't know. It's interesting. I don't know that it's, you know, I think it's, I mean, obviously there are tribes like the Cherokee Nation itself, which does not use blood quantum. You know, an ancestor who's on the rolls. And
I think that what is probably interesting about this is really the view from the white community. I think there's a view from the white community of Black people passing, but there really is no discussion or view from white people of what it is where Native people are passing.
Well, I mean, I think that there are people some people who are white who are pretending to be Indians, right? And there are people who do this for decades of their life. You know, they rely on that sort of mythology of white passing Indians to make their stories seem real. And I mean, I think that because being a citizen of a Native nation is not about a race, it's about citizenship. It's a political designation, not a racial designation. And so therefore it's a different thing, you know.
But that's not how white people view it.
And that's an incorrect that's an incorrect perception, and that is one which Warren has been guilty of promoting to hundreds of millions of Americans. And so this is the problem, and it's actually being utilized by right-wing conservative organizations like the Goldwater Institute, which are seeking to get, they actually won a case with the Indian Child Welfare Act in Texas federal court to get Indian termed a race-based, to be race-based and therefore unconstitutional. And if they can get that, if they can get the Supreme Court to agree, right, then everything, every legal document that has the term Indian in it will become void. And that includes treaties. So she's playing into a perception of us as being race-based, right, that is really dangerous to Native people and to Native nations.
I understand that, but I'm really interested in the perception from the angle of the majority, and I'll put forward an hypothesis, and that is that
I think I already answered your question, and so we'll you know, I think that white people think is very important because they're very powerful and they can cause a lot of harm, but I think that in the end what white people need to do is listen to Native people, listen to people of color, and to understand how we see ourselves.
Okay, well, thank you, Camilla. And I want to read, can I read a little bit from this Custer Died for Your Sins, which kind of is the title of the Floyd Westerman album from which we
That's
played
my
that
grandma's cousin.
Cut. And it's this, and it's a relative of yours. And this is a chapter called The Red and the Black. And of course, you know, his song, The Red, White, and the Black, obviously leaves out, you know, the whole idea of color, you know, putting colors to is, you know, it does sort of play into the whole, you know, racial mythologizing, and it's all fraught and all very complicated. And it leaves out, you know, Asian people. It leaves out, you know, we're a much more complex society than just that. But there's reasons why he focuses on the red and the black in this chapter. Basically, I'll set the stage, is because he's writing in the, I think this came out in the late 60s, when there was a lot of, you know, because of the civil rights movement, he's talking about the civil rights movement and how Native people relate or don't relate to that, and how basically, you know, because so much attention was focused on African Americans, they basically, you know, had to sort of, you know, shove Native people into programs that were basically focusing on African Americans. And there's a certain amount of resentment to that. Anyway, here, this is talking about the question sort of also that Camilla was raising. There was probably a historical basis for this type of thinking. In many states in the last century, Indians were classified as white by laws passed to exclude blacks. So there was a connotation that Indians might in some way be like whites. But in other areas, particularly marriage laws, Indians were classified as blacks. And this connotation really determined the role into which the white man forced the red man. Consequently, as far as most race relations were concerned, Indians were classified as non-whites. There has been no way to positively determine in which category Indians belong when it comes to federal agencies. The Bureau of Indian Affairs consistently define Indians as good guys who have too much dignity to demonstrate, hoping to keep the Indian people separate from the ongoing civil rights movement. Other agencies generally adopted a semi-black orientation. Sometimes Indians were treated as if they were blacks and other times not. And it goes on, and it's worth reading. It's, you know, there's some aspects that are dated, but this is very,
well,
very profound
actually,
analysis.
My favorite part of that chapter is when he's discussing how tribal leaders viewed the civil rights movement, and they had some critiques, right? And their number one critique was that that white people could get laws passed, right, like the Voting Rights Act and stuff, but white people in the end would never allow black people to be part of their society. And that the best thing that, and they felt the only thing that made sense was black nationalism. And I mean, I know this sounds kind of, but they were very supportive of Stokely Carmichael, and they felt that his critique was way more valid. And they were very insistent that they're fighting for civil rights. And the tribes, they're there fighting for their sovereignty, and that really, that to a certain extent, the black community should look at sovereignty. And when I was rereading that chapter during Ferguson, I was thinking, like, looking at a town where so many, the black community was being oppressed and ruled over by a white minority, right? And I was thinking, like, you know, they are unable to protect themselves from this, you know, and maybe there is something to that critique of Indian leaders in the 60s of the civil rights movement.
Well, as we've talked privately, you and I, it would be interesting to have a round table discussion with African Americans and others. I mean, it gets, you have to kind of limit, but also open up the discussion. But we have another caller on the line. Harry, go ahead. You're on the air.
Oh, greetings, everyone, and thank you for taking my call. I have two questions, one about mascots and one about Red Face. About mascots, here in Portland, we have a semi-pro team called the Portland Winterhawks. And over the years, they have always used Indian symbols to represent their team. But
a figure in a headdress, yeah.
Yeah. And I was wondering they were going to change it because it would be very easy because a winter hawk is a bird, right?
Yep.
And couldn't they just say, hey, just change it back to a bird, and that would be better. But I was wondering, do you know what, is there any works on having them change?
Yeah, I've been asked about this before, and I don't think there has been any movement. It's funny because the team actually got the mascot because they got hand-me-down jerseys from the Blackhawks. That's the only reason we have that mascot. And I would think that it wouldn't be a big deal to change it. And in fact, you know, studies, and there is actually a mock-up of a hawk version that was done by Native folks in Chicago, a mascot, which would be good to look at. But the actually studies done by Emory University and in 2015 found that it says here, according to Emory University sports marketing research study, MLB teams using Native American mascots cost themselves about $2.6 million a year in revenue by sticking with the frequently lamented caricatures. So what they did was they did a study of the largest kind of cohort of teams that ever changed from Native mascots to other mascots, which would be the NCAA, the college and university teams that were forced to do so. And so they took that data set and they looked at it, and they found that 2 years later, that audience participation and identification with the team actually went up. And so from that, they surmised that actually having a Native mascot, a human-based mascot, was actually distancing to the audience, to the fan base. And they actually had a huge bump in audience participation once they got rid of it. So
And the of course you heard about the Cleveland Indians removing his name, Chief Wahoo, from their uniform.
Yes, yeah.
And of course they also have the Atlanta Braves.
So
which doesn't seem to be that part
I mean, yeah, I think so. I mean, well, the Chief Wahoo, you know, I was interviewed by Public Radio International, The World, last year, actually, mm-hmm. about this, and you can see it online. It's an hour-long conversation we had when they got rid of Chief Wahoo. And I was born in Cleveland, and my parents, you know, as young people, they met there and they protested against him. I think that's, and actually, I'm going to be speaking in Cleveland in March. I think that definitely it's you know, it's a huge improvement getting rid of that grotesque caricature, and I'm glad I didn't grow up in Cleveland having to have that all over the place. We moved away when I was a preschooler, but I definitely think that the performative aspect of things like Indians or, you know, the Kansas City Chiefs. Even though even the Kansas City Chief, the name was originally in reference to a mayor of Kansas City, a white mayor who they called the Chief, right? And it had nothing to do with Native Americans. But I mean, the Indian, even the name Indian is problematic because they call themselves the tribe. It just, they begin to appropriate and to... I know, you know, Ohio is a place where Native people were removed after Tecumseh lost at Falling Timbers in the early 1800s. And so having my parents met there during relocation, which was a program that Congress a law they passed to terminate tribes in the 1950s, and then to relocate the populace to urban centers. And Cleveland was one of those urban centers which Native young people were supposed to leave the reservation and go to. And so my parents were part of like 20,000 young Native people that suddenly descended on the city of Cleveland after having no Indians since Tecumseh lost. And over 130 years earlier, you know, and so they and they immediately began organizing to get rid of that mascot. And so it's, you know, I think that I often say that mascots mask our lived realities. And so certainly that is the experience of it.
Well, ask your second question about Red Face, and then we got another caller and we got to wrap up.
Go ahead. Okay, good. About Red Face. Well, the 2010 census said that there's only four races, European, white, African, black, Asian, yellow, and Native American, or whatever, is usually red. So, and the, like, the name Oklahoma means land of the red people, if I'm correct. So I'm, so it's not the color red, is it? Because people coming up from South America, they call them brown people, which technically they're probably part Native American, correct?
Yeah, I mean, but I think that the way it's used, like I told you, I invented the term masketry, and because the issue is not the image itself, the issue is what is done with it, right? And where it's taken. And so, you know, yes, you know, there are terms that are, you know, we like to call ourselves the Red Nation, but it's different when you're doing it for yourself than when your enemies are doing it to you, right? It's different, like, as if you're being bullied or mocked in school, you know, and it's different when your bullies are saying these things to you versus when your family is saying it to you who love you, right? It's a completely different context. And the triumphalism aspect of it, the taking on of a defeated enemy and parading it around and doing it at will with very little knowledge. And I think another aspect is that studies show that that mascots, the University of Buffalo did a study where they found that mascots promote primarily negative stereotypes, Native mascots do, and not only about Native people, but about all races. So for a pluralistic society, the promotion of stereotypes about each other is incredibly damaging to the democratic process. And really, it's unnecessary. It's something that, when you think about it, is done purely for entertainment purposes. Is it more important than us getting along as a nation?
Well, listen, I'm sure you probably had more to say there, Harry, but we have another caller, and there's a couple other things we wanted to talk about. So thank you, Harry, as always, for calling. Before we go into this last thing about your, speaking of Ohio, your trip to Cincinnati, which we kind of wanted to talk a little more about, let's just hear, if you can have state your question or comment fairly briefly, Mike, that would be appreciated. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Oh, it's just hoping you could shine a light on the real positive and efforts in local schools in Oregon and other places. I think those are great stories, and it's brought the community together to change mascots and so forth. So thank you for the discussion.
Or do you have some stories you'd like to share yourself? Sorry, I guess I shouldn't have asked him to be brief.
I know. Yeah. Well, I mean, I think that you know, we've done incredible work here in Oregon. The Oregon American Education Association led that movement to get rid of mascots in high schools here in Oregon, and the Board of Education really supported that. You know, there is the schools do have the ability to work with local tribes, with one of the 9 federally recognized tribes in Oregon, to get permission to use the mascots with the tribe's oversight. And it's been a great process, and also the state of Oregon, the legislature legislators passed a bill to mandate education about the tribes. And so so many people will claim, well, it's the only way, Indian people will disappear and not be known if they're not mascotted. Well, that's not true. And so the work done here in Oregon has been really great. And I credit folks like Seattle, my friend Seattle Edmo, and many folks with the Oregon Education Association, the leadership of the many legislators and the Board of Education and on this.
And I do apologize, Mike. I didn't mean to cut you off like that, because I'm sure you would have had some things to share with us. So talk about, you're talking about Ohio. Talk about this, I said you keep being called back into the fray, and you jump back into it by being invited by the university, by the Miami tribe, right, to go to
Ohio. So a couple weeks ago, I was actually I was invited to Oxford, Ohio, where Miami University is, to debate pro-mascot people. And I was invited by the Miami tribe of Oklahoma. And of course, the Miami tribe used to be based in Ohio until they were removed, right, to Oklahoma. And so they had invited me to come and debate these folks. And I was pretty I had a lot of trepidation because this group is funded. We believe that they are funded by Dan Snyder, the owner of the Washington NFL team. And they're a mixture of sort of some Dakota people and then straight up pretendians, people who are pretending to be Indian. And they go around and he flies them all over the country to go to school boards and tell them that Indians love being mascotted, to try to stop them from getting rid of their native mascot. So and that was happening at a local school there. So I was invited to go out there, and I did. I mean, I have a lot of feeling for the people, Indian people in Ohio, having been born there, and so and the battle in which they fight in isolation, because of the course of the complete genocide that occurred there in that state, and so I went, and while I was there, and I did have my argument with them, and I think we won. So, and actually, and the school
was board, an official debate. Did someone declare a winner?
Well, it was pretty obviously we won, because these people were kind of crazy, yeah, and they're their own worst enemy. Let's put it that way. And so, and then the school board did vote to get rid of the mascot.
Oh, right on.
Yes, and Miami University itself had gotten rid of its native mascot in conjunction with the Miami tribe. They worked with them on that. And then it so happened at the same time the whole Covington thing happened, the Covington Catholic thing. And so
on the mall or in
yes,
D.C.
In D.C., yeah. So I was invited by local Native people there. And Oxford, Ohio, and Covington, Kentucky are both suburbs of Cincinnati, Ohio. Cincinnati is on the border of Kentucky and Ohio. So just across the Ohio River is Covington, Kentucky from Cincinnati. So they, the Cincinnati Native American organization invited me to come with them to speak to Covington, the Covington Catholic Diocese the next day. So I went, and we weren't allowed to speak to the diocese because there were bomb threats and they were on lockdown. But they spoke to the media, and I was also interviewed by NPR, WBUR in Boston when I was live on the site. And then later, the next day I was interviewed by Audie Cornish on All Things Considered. And
so do you think that bomb threat was connected to the event?
Well, they claim it was. Yeah. I mean, it's so, but they did not meet with the Native community. They refused to meet with the Native community. The Native community was presenting them a proposal for education about Native issues.
So this is the fallout from that event. So there have been attempts to actually engage with them, and they haven't been.
Oh, yeah. They presented them with curriculum to teach their kids so they know more about Native people. And, they haven't been that great about that. And so, so that was really interesting. I got to see all that while I was in Cleveland, and I also got to speak at the Martin Luther King Day thing that Monday. It was on that day that I had the debate, and in downtown Cincinnati in like 6-degree weather. it was very cold there, but yeah.
So the struggle continues. At least you find yourself in continually interesting situations.
Oh my God! It's been very. It does seem like Native issues are in the news cycle, the national news cycle, almost every 2 weeks now. It's crazy, and it's as a journalist, it's really hard to keep up with, and it's particularly difficult when there's so much education we have to do just to be able to get the general public to understand our issues, and of course stereotypes, red face, blackface, masketry, all make it that much more difficult.
Well, I just want to let people know that coming up next on The Radioactivist will be an hour of analysis on victims' rights, as well as the school-to-prison pipeline, with guests Shannon Wright from the Partnership for Safety and Justice and Renee Mitchell with Youth Organized United to help after that Flashpoints. Then The Dirt Bag with Master Gardener Glenn Andreessen. All this KBOO program is made possible by member support. To become a member, if you haven't, go to KBOO.FM and click on donate. Thank you once again, Jacqueline, as always.
Thanks for having me,
it's
Paul.
It's a pleasure and interest. And you can go to the program page at KBOO.FM, Wednesday Talk Radio, and look at a bunch of links. I'm going to include also this article. My friend Guy Lopez is trying to get his alma mater, University of Virginia, to look at Native Americans as part of their school's segregation commission. And of course, they were classified as black, and so many of them were basically disappeared, essentially, which is something that's happened in a lot of places.
And also, you can check out my blog, Tioshbaya, now,
yes.
And it will be on link on there. And I will be doing a newsletter kind of documenting everything I've been doing for the past month. And I also actually got to see the swearing in of Deb Holland, Representatives Deb Holland and Sharice Davids, the first Native American woman congresswoman, which happened so long ago now. It feels like I've kind of,
Things are moving so fast and so bizarrely. And of course, there's also links to all these articles on red face, some on blackface, and more. And I will include, and I should do that on a regular basis, include the link to your blog. What's the name of it again?
Tioshbaya Now. And Tioshbaya, it means, in Dakota, it means it's a circle of teepees that, you know, we used to live in community and family with, and which people were loved and safe and taken care of. So it's sort of an aspirational.
And that will be spelled out with the, you can click on the link directly to see her blog. Okay, that's it for now. This is Paul Rowland with Wednesday Talk Radio. Coming up next, The Radioactivist.
America, you invite the red man to sit at your table and be your guest, to justify the guilt that you are feeling. Now you tell us that you like us the best, and the black man waiting on the sidelines for the chance to get into your game, to show you that he's just as good as you are, to prove to you that he can be the same. And the triangle that you have created keeps you by yourself and keeps you paranoid, for the red, white, and blue that you keep flying.